So our scripture reading this morning comes from the book of Matthew, Gospel of Matthew, chapter 23, verses 1 through 12. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. Therefore, do whatever they teach you and follow it. But do not do as they do, for they do not practice what they teach. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on the shoulders of others, but they themselves are unwilling to lift a finger to move them. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the best seats in the synagogues, and to be greeted and respected in the marketplaces, and to have people call them rabbi. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all students. And call no one your father on earth, for you have only one father, the one in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant." Thus ends the reading of God's word. All who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all who humble themselves will be exalted. I make mistakes too. Okay. I'll admit that. Okay. All right. So I can recall a time and a place where I believed that my parents to be wise beyond measure. They could say anything, and I believed it to be true. They were the smartest people alive. I would ask a question like, "When can I go outside to play?" And they would say, "In a minute." They knew in a minute was going to come. Their response, and it was always interesting, telling me when things were going to happen. "How long until we get to Grandma and Grandpa's house?" Their response, "About 3 more hours." "What are we having for dinner?" "Meatloaf." Mind blown. They knew everything. For a time, I thought they had it all. And then I turned 4, and everything changed. For one, my questions got a little bit harder. Instead of asking how or when or where questions, I infused the dreaded why. And sometimes that would be my only question. Why? They would say something like, "Well, you need to be sure to eat all of your vegetables." And I would say, "Why?" And then I would say something like, "You should brush your teeth before you go to bed." "Why?" "Don't hit your brother." "Why?" I don't know if it was their IQs dropped significantly or that mine had been increased so quickly, but their answers became incoherent and their status of wise had gone out the window. I started to hear things like, "Because I said so," and "Don't you talk back to me," or "Do as I say," okay? As a 4 or 5-year-old boy, these things didn't make sense to me. They were not answers. They were merely words or demands. They did not explain anything except just do it. There's no rhyme or reason to it. Just do it, okay? They were outdated, and I believed my parents were past their prime, if you will. They could not answer even the simplest of questions anymore. This was my rationalization, and I was sticking to it until I became a parent. My boy started asking me the questions, "Why?" And I was like, "Ugh." Was I losing my mind? Had my IQ dropped 20 points overnight? All of a sudden, I could not answer anything. No matter how hard I tried, my answers just never seemed to be enough. I would explain my reasons and my rationale, but to no avail, Tate would always say, "But why?" Then another kid came, and another kid came, and eventually our token response became, "Because God says so, so you gotta ask God, okay?" I'm not trying to answer it anymore, all right? Suddenly my whole world did not make any sense. I was incoherent. I was a rambling mess. I started questioning my own thoughts and my beliefs and rationalizations. I had become my parents. I knew what was right, but I could not for the life of me explain why it was right. I found myself realizing that I did not always follow my own expectations. That became a problem. At times I forgot to say the blessing, right, before a meal, or I felt a little white lie so long as you were protecting someone's feelings was okay. So growing up, I came to the conclusion that the world was not necessarily black and white anymore. As a kid, I assumed that every question had a reasonable answer, right? Over time, I realized that this was not the case. Instead of having a clear and concise answer for all the questions, most of them were tinged with shades of gray. Before kids, I could skip over the discrepancies. I wasn't being called out on them, right? But after kids, I had to hit them head on. The confident, reasonable, and rational person I'd always claimed to be had left the building. All that was left was a dazed and confused soul, one that had a difficult time distinguishing right from wrong, left from right, good from bad. Our scripture lesson this morning speaks to this occasion. In Matthew's gospel, we find Jesus, or at least the gospel authors attempt to tell a story about Jesus, dismissing the Pharisees as rambling conveyors of the truth. They were telling the truth, but also individuals who did not practice what they preached. They became like parents who were living lives without children. They got used to things. Their deeds and following of the laws had not been questioned by anybody. They understood Torah and the laws that they must follow. They were able to share those laws with others, but found it really hard to actually live by those laws in real life. They did not have anybody sitting down questioning their every move, nor were they questioning the motives. So the Pharisees continued to live a life kind of skimming over the things that they couldn't do themselves. They saw it as their duty, though, to ensure that others understood the law and followed it. Apparently, Matthew thought that some, not all, of the Pharisees started out with good intentions, but became completely self-interested later. The Pharisees were a sect of Judaism that existed alongside many others in Palestine, the Jewish society living around 200 BCE to about 100 CE. They were probably educated bureaucrats. They were the synagogue priests, the ones who were in charge of the synagogues outside of Jerusalem, and they sought to preserve Israel's identity by a strict adherence to purity and Sabbath laws. And they were influential in Jewish society and were looked upon favorably by most of the people. Okay, the Pharisees and their interpretations were favored by the people because they would take Jewish tradition and laws and make them very tangible, practical things. Right? They worked in the society in which they lived, in their daily life. For example, the Pharisees taught people to regard the gathering around the household dinner table as a community of worship, right? The handling of food and dishes were religious activities. They weren't just simple things you do on a daily basis. They became very practical, sacred events, okay? So they made sure that everybody did that. The Pharisees' goal was to provide a fence around the law. In other words, to protect it from infringement by surrounding it with specific rules. And the original purpose was admirable, to enhance the inward faithfulness of people in their daily lives. But in practice, they had a tendency to multiply those rules, to kind of expand upon those rules, add to those rules. And it got to the point that keeping the law, okay, actually became a burden rather than a celebratory experience. So, for example, Jews could go for a walk on the Sabbath, right? But however, they could only go roughly two-thirds of a mile, okay? Because a distance that was determined by reference to the space between the people of Israel and the Ark of the Covenant within the confines of the land of Canaan. So that was it. They couldn't go any further. So they had a very tangible rule. So the Pharisees continued to attempt to create specifics for living a good life based on law became their downfall. They could speak the language, but did not realize that they could not adequately live the language. Strict adherence to the law made the most rational sense, however, in daily practice, not so much. It became a burden or a hindrance, an impossibility, really, to be able to live by the law that they had ascribed. Much like a parent who struggles with teaching a child the most appropriate way of talking to his or her siblings or friends and why it's important not to lie. They find themselves knowing the right answers, but understanding that they actually fall short in living out such answers. In our story today, Jesus is confronting these Pharisees and trying to teach the disciples a lesson. The author of Matthew quotes Jesus as saying to his disciples, "But do not do as they do, for they do not practice what they teach," in reference to the Pharisees. "They tie up heavy burdens and hard to bear, and they lay them on the shoulders of others, but they themselves are unwilling to lift a finger to move them. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long. They love to have the place of honor at the banquets and the best seats in the synagogues, and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces, and to have people call them rabbi." So Jesus, in his plea today to his disciples, he's pointing something out, a flaw, if you will, in the Pharisees and what they're doing. Their interpretation of the law is problematic, but Jesus notes their willingness to follow the law, tying up the heavy burdens. Yes, it's a noble endeavor, but he also noted something even more important, their lack of humbleness and humility, their desire to be right, to be honored, to be greeted with respect. He was pointing out that it was the Pharisees' lack of humility that ultimately disrupted their otherwise noble path of following God's commandments. In Matthew's account, Jesus wanted the disciples to recognize that what self-importance or self-centeredness can do, even to the most dedicated and well-intentioned soul. Jesus knew that the disciples were flawed. We got a lot of gospels that are littered with stories of their own boasting and their incompetence, really. So therefore, he wanted to ensure that they did not fall victim to the cultural norm of preaching a good message in the wrong vein. So what magical explanation did Jesus give, okay, to the disciples? What tidbit of advice did he provide to the flawed followers? Surely it wasn't simply be humble, right? For most do not understand the depths of that work. Most believe themselves to be humble when in fact they are seeking recognition for that work. Take my acquaintance and DOC colleague, Chris Pyatt. He was telling me of an example that happened. A young man approached him after his service, one of humility and humbleness, and he said, "That was a really good message today." He said, "I always like hearing about how humble we're supposed to be in our Christian walk." Then Christian said, the guy sat back, took a deep breath, thought really heavily, and he said, "Personally, I'm a pretty humble guy. I'm actually much more humble than I tend to give myself credit for." Somewhat ironic, eh? How we all fall victim to this, right? We think that, oh, it's about me boasting about myself and how humble I really am. The Pharisees were so determined to follow the law that they failed to recognize that portions of their elaborated law became impossibly hard. Our disciples were always looking for approval and acceptance for deeds rather than simply doing the deed without recognition of being accepted by others. Parents are just overwhelmed by the intricacies of being a parent and the authoritative person that they are and the all-knowing person that they are for their children. They forget to say, "I don't know," or "I'm not sure." Surely Jesus explains what humbleness or humility is and what it looks like. We get a little hint in verses 8 through 11. He says, "But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all students. And call no one your father on earth, for you have one father, the one in heaven. Nor are you able to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant." So yes, that's important. It gives us a glimpse of what humbleness actually looks like, right? But in our culture, this gets muddy. This gets really muddy. The words spoken in these verses can be easily overlooked or misinterpreted when we live in a society that requires its people to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, or "they should not tread on me," right? Some want to interpret verses 8 through 11 as an attempt to put the elite in their place, okay? Making sure that it's the status that becomes their problem, not their behavior. And I'm here to say it is their behavior that gets them in problems and is the problem, okay? Behaviors that can be emulated by any person regardless of their status, okay? It could be rich or poor people can follow that bad behavior. We can all fall victim to it. You can be weak, you can be strong. Either way, you can provide this bad behavior, okay? This sense that I'm trying to be humble for the wrong reasons, okay? Educated, non-educated, old, young, so forth and so on. Regardless of where we are on the journey, we can all be self-centered and arrogant and lose our focus. The prosperous among us are not the only ones prone to this act. Also, the vulnerable, they are too. Humbleness is a mindset that requires focus and dedication, no matter your status. Another thing that muddies up verses 8 through 11 is the fact that kind of we have a culture of consciousness filtering from our culture that explains humility or humbleness as humiliating oneself or belittling oneself. The word humble can be seen as a negative thing in our world. Those who are humble cannot care for themselves, nor are they seen as important. Jesus, in his witness to the disciples, wants us to recognize that humility is not self-abasement, meaning we are weak when we are humble. That's what some people lead you to believe. We can be very strong if we understand the true act of being humble. Being humble means recognizing an infinite power greater than ourselves. It means so much more than we give it credit. Humility and humbleness requires an understanding that God is present and alive in our world, working through us to help the world understand and know the right way to live. When we recognize this living God within ourselves, we know that we can make a difference. We know that we can move the world forward without destroying the message. You know, we may be asking ourselves, how can this happen? How can we live this life? As a teacher and a parent, this is the way I see it. Most parents and teachers know that secret little twinge that pricks the consciousness when their child boasts of a playmate and puffs up with pride. Perhaps that twinge is concern that our parental cheerleading, our encouragement to try to find that right friend or the good friend, has turned our son or daughter into an egoist rather than a self-confident but modest child. Where does humility come in when self-esteem and self-confidence are valued so highly in our society? When we recognize our true selves with every breath, and joyfully acknowledge all that is possible through the infinite that is our true self, the infinite being God, we can show children how humility and success can go hand in hand. Teach children confidence in their true selves, not the I that they've created, not the me, not the mine, the things that I want to see happen, but the true self, which is God incarnate in them. Cheer them on. Help them to see the amazing possibilities open to them when they see God within themselves and others. The outward self is not so important as allowing the true self, the God-infused self, the spirit in all of us, to do incredible and wonderful things through them and with them and for them. So what I'm asking you today is to recognize the beautiful spirit within you as your true self, the Spirit of God. Let go of your attachment to the person you define yourself as, the one where we are the great parent and they listen to us, one where we are the great teacher and they should listen to us, and one where we have all the answers. There really is no independent I. We are all interconnected, and we are all the same at our deepest levels. Begin by remembering a time when you experienced either a professional or a personal success. Think of something that good has happened in your life. Oftentimes we want to say, this is me. I did this. I worked so hard that this happened, right? So take that, put that in your brain. Notice all the ways that something deeper played a role in that success. It may be helpful to consider some of the following ways that God or your true self guides you in your life. Think about this. When this success was happening, did you get any intuitive hunches? Were you inspired with new thoughts or creative ideas? Did circumstances seem to fall into place easily and effortlessly? Did you receive just the right resource at just the right time? Did you feel a surge of energy or determination at any time? Did you receive help, encouragement, or ideas from other people? The Spirit also works through others. Our successes are not our own. We have to recognize the deep, true self, the Spirit that is infused in us, and recognize that it is there. And something deeper and authentic is flowing through our successes. It doesn't diminish them, it actually expands them. If we can do these things in our lives, if we can teach our true children what true humility and humbleness are, if we can show them that it means we understand that God is inside of us, giving us a true self, we can live out God's message and love in this world together. And it'll help us to remove the conundrum of humbleness as being weak, and the belief that remove the conundrum of humbleness being strict. And it'll fuse a sense of togetherness and of God. Help your children and others know that being humble means remembering everything you have and everything you've done are the presence of God. Thanks be to God.